From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to this additional episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Oral History Special number 3. Hello, this is Mark, the podcast producer. We're still in a national lockdown here in the UK, and as we did during the lockdown last year, we're bringing you, our listeners, some extra content. Our VE Day and VJ Day, It Happened Here episodes last year, featured short clips from dozens of our veterans telling us what they got up to on those historic days. With these oral history specials, we can finally bring you the longer versions of those interviews, allowing our veterans to tell their own stories, in their own voices, and in their own way. Vital to us capturing these interviews are a team of brilliant volunteers who go and visit our veterans at home to record them. So in this episode, we join one of those oral history volunteers, Mike Chapman, who in 2017 travelled up to the Scottish borders to interview Mary Sherard. Mary recorded a fascinating and especially long interview with Mike. So we're going to bring you this in two parts. In this first part, Mary tells us about joining the Women's Royal Naval Service, the Wrens, and then arriving at Bletchley Park in 1942.
My name's Mike Chapman. I'm an oral history volunteer for the Bletchley Park Trust. It is Saturday, the 17th of June, 2017, and I'm at the home of one of our Bletchley Park veterans near Duns in the Scottish Borders.
And my name is Mary Sherard. It was Mary Stiven, and I am going to give a little bit of my story to you. I want to recall how the Enigma operation contributed to the winning of World War II, and in doing so, I'll be giving you quite a lot of my own story. And what do I mean by the Enigma operation? It was the cracking of the Enigma machine code used by Nazi Germany, and it has been reckoned that because we were able to decipher the coded messages sent out by Nazi Germany, that the war was shortened and thousands of lives were saved. Nazi Germany believed that their codes were unbreakable, and they continued to believe that throughout the war. The story of Enigma has been well documented over recent years, but the story stems from the memory of those of us who worked at Bletchley Park. So this is my story of how I came to work at Bletchley Park as a member of the Women's Royal Naval Service and of some of the people I met. I was 16 when World War II began, living in Glasgow, about to enter Form 5 and sit my hires examination. Because there was a belief that major cities would be subject to air attacks, I, along with my two young sisters and my young cousin, was evacuated to Les Mahago. It was, for me, not an unhappy experience. It was a time of growing up and accepting responsibilities for my young relatives. So in January 1940, my school, the Glasgow High School for Girls, reopened, and I returned there to study for my hires. I'd already set my sights on volunteering for the forces when I was old enough. Three notable events strengthened that decision to enlist. Our headmistress, who had shielded us from boys save at our chaperoned school dances, informed us that we in Form 5 were to host a party for the men of the Free French Forces on leave in Glasgow. And we were urged by our teachers to befriend and entertain these gallant young men, not so very much older than us. Many were from Poland. Nearly all had lost their entire families. And I met Reinhold Schmitzek, a dashing young Polish pilot, reckless to the extreme, courteous, but with one thought, to rid the world of Nazis who had butchered all his loved ones. And I took Reinhold home, and my parents treated him as a son, and he spent leaves with us, and I remember I travelled to London to meet him. It was inevitable that he was shot down and killed, and he knew and he accepted that that was how it had to be. He lived longer than many of his daredevil pilot colleagues. They served our country well, and they helped us win the Battle of Britain. You must tell the story of Reinhold, says my elder grandson, for how else can he live on? Living in Glasgow in 1940 with us was Dr. Stein, a youngish German Christian Jew who had witnessed the murder of her entire family by the Nazis in 1938 and had herself escaped and eventually arrived in Scotland. She was a medical doctor, and I used to walk with her in the Botanic Gardens and listen to her stories. The Clydebank Blitz of 1941 strengthened my desire to join up. We lived at this time in the west end of Glasgow, and our flat was damaged by a landmine which fell nearby. We were in the shelter, we were unhurt, but not so many of my school friends. And I remember the shock of the loss of my friend Kathleen, who, with her mother, her sister and her brothers, was killed that night. I remember Clydebank burning, the sky alight, my father on home guard duty, my mother called to an emergency centre to help with the homeless. And a delightful memory. The landmine brought down the wall of our basement shelter right into the bedroom of Elsie, the Aberdeen cook of our neighbours. In no time at all, Elsie appeared through the rubble, through all the dust, bearing a silver tray with tea and scones. "Oh, they fleeing things are making a nuffin noise the night," she said. I remember my father came to see that we were safe, insisted that we ventured out of the shelter to see Clydebank burning. So when I was old enough to volunteer for the WRNS, I dearly wanted to be a Wren. I come from a seagoing family. Recruitment in Glasgow was restricted to those who could speak German. I was unsure if my knowledge of German was good enough, but my father encouraged me to apply, and I did. And my interview was with a very handsome naval officer, and I wondered a little bit if my knowledge of German was sufficient. However, I was asked almost immediately if I would agree to work for my country in the WRNS in a job that was and would remain top secret. There'd be no promotion prospects, there'd be no recognition of the work undertaken. I would be assigned to Special Duties X as a Wren. Some 30 years later, I discovered from my mother that my family had been investigated. And she had worried because her parents, although Scottish, had become naturalised American citizens, and she thought this might count against whatever was being considered. It obviously did not. My mother, of course, had no idea why the family was being checked out. And so in 1942, I became a Wren. I had to survive a short period of introduction to Wren life at Mill Hill in London, and I remember I was assigned to galley duty, and I had to report at about 5 o'clock each morning. This, however, posed no difficulty, as we seldom slept in our cabins. Due to air raids, we were in the shelter most nights. But I finally arrived at my quarters in Gayhurst, a lovely old house in the village of Newport Pagnell. And there I learned I was to work at Bletchley Park. I'd be taken there each day by coach. Newport Pagnell is about 8 miles north of Bletchley. Bletchley is about 47 miles north of London. And I had to sign the Official Secrets Act. It was all exciting, and yet in many ways it was no big deal. After all, there was a war on. But if friends or relatives asked about our work, we could only say we were writers attached to HMS Pembroke 5. So what was the work I had to do? The breaking of the German Enigma codes and the effect that that had on the war has been much in the news since about 1974, when the restrictions of secrecy were lifted. And that's what we were about. We were trained to break the Enigma codes.
So that was very, very interesting. Actually, that was a great introduction. I think you made a good call by going through that. So you were recruited in 1942. Can you remember what month it was?
My birthday is in April.
Right.
And I was 19 then, so it was around that time. And it was September 1942 until I was called to Mill Hill.
At Mill Hill, you remember you did some galley duty, and what else did they teach? What else did they cover? Can you remember?
I just remember very much the work in the galley.
Right.
And I remember I put on so much weight because we lived on potatoes and bread. And we were not given any inkling of the kind of work we were going to go on to. We did learn naval language. We had to talk about our bedrooms as cabins and that sort of thing. And we were to work watches, probably, where we were being sent, not shifts. Do you know? Yeah. It was that kind of thing, very basic stuff.
Yes.
And had we had a hat band, it would have said HMS Pembroke 5, but we didn't have hat bands because of the war.
Did you wear any other badges, any other insignia on your uniform?
No.
Nothing?
No. We were issued with our uniform, though, at Mill Hill, I believe.
So what rank were you when you started?
Wren.
Ordinary Wren.
Ordinary Wren.
Right. So you went from Mill Hill to Gatehurst. Can you remember how you made that journey?
We made that journey by bus, think it was, yes, by coach.
And was there a group of you or were you on your own?
There were two of us. Jean Wright was from Dumfries in Scotland, and me. And as far as I could make out, for many a month, right up until about 1943, when there was a huge intake to the Wrens, we were the only Scottish girls. And that had a big bearing on our introduction to Wren life. And Jean Wright and I were very good friends, because we were the only Scottish recruits, as far as I know.
And you said Gatehurst Manor was a lovely place, interesting place near Newport Pagnell. What do you remember about the accommodation there? Were you sharing rooms? Was it bunk beds?
Gatehurst Manor, now I've got... living at Gatehurst was very pleasant. The manor house is a fine building dating back to 1086. Francis Drake owned it in 1581, and Everard Digby lived there from 1596. He was executed for his part in the gunpowder plot of 1605, and his ghost lives on at Gatehurst. Wrens would meet him on Digby's Walk in the grounds, particularly on the night of November the 5th. Sir Walter Carlyle was the owner when war broke out, and the house was requisitioned as an outstation of Bletchley Park. About 60 Wrens lived there, but Sir Walter and his family continued to live in one wing. And I remember his staff used the secret passages and the sliding wall panels as shortcuts as they went about their household duties. I was in a cabin on the top floor. The loos were very grand affairs up there, and they were said to be haunted, and so we never lingered very long in the loos. We'd a lovely old church in the grounds and could attend services there when our duties allowed. An escaped Italian prisoner of war claimed sanctuary in that church while I was there, and security was stepped up. But we did have very interesting times when we came off duty, particularly after the evening watch and the night watch, and we were ushered into a lovely room always for a meal to be served. And we would be completely thrown when the wall would slide back and out would step one of the servants of Sir Walter. I remember the very first time I saw that, it was about 1 a.m, and out he came, carrying a silver tray with Sir Walter's whiskey. It was a strange way to live. We were restricted very much in what we could do because of our security and because of the isolation of Gatehurst. But we did hold dances, we did attend dances, but we were always chaperoned. We'd very, very little time off because we had our work at Bletchley Park, we had our travel, and that took quite a bit of time, and we had household duties. But I do remember summer afternoons on the lawn at Gayhurst, sunbathing, listening to an old wind-up gramophone playing the music of Casablanca as time goes by. And I also remember wrens lying sunbathing on the flat roof of Gayhurst, and planes from the nearby airfield would sweep low over them in greeting. And alas, this led to the powers that be forbidding such sunbathing. We'd a nearby neighbour who owned racehorses, and he encouraged us to exercise his horses because, of course, he wasn't able to race them during the war. And I did a bit of horse riding, and I took a tumble once and had to report to the medical officer, and I was reprimanded by this medical officer severely as he bound up my arm. You're here to win the war, not exercise frisky horses. So that's my memory of Gayhurst.
Wonderful.
Is that okay?
That was brilliant.
And
it really was.
A whole year I lived like that.
Right.
Going in every day, or, you know, either day shift, or it was day watch, or evening watch, or night watch.
What sort of hours were those? Can you remember?
8 hours. It was 8 till 4, 4 till midnight, midnight till 8
till
in the morning.
Right.
And we worked a monthly schedule. A week of day watch, a week of evening watch, a week of night watch. And the fourth week, we had 3 to 4 days of 8 hours on, 8 hours off, 8 hours on, 8 hours off. And the rest of that week was free. That was our only free time in the month. And it usually worked out we had 3 to 4 days at the end of a month when we could go home on a short leave.
Right.
But Jean Wright and I could not go home. Because I don't know, you'll probably know very much how difficult it was to travel. We could have got home, but we could not have guaranteed to get back in such a short time. I remember, for instance, when I was going home on annual leave, I would go to Euston Station and queue on the platform. No timetable, just waiting for a train to come in that would take us to Scotland. There would be so many service people standing on the platform that when the train did come in, you perhaps could not get on it. And I remember on one occasion standing there in despair because of the crowds of service people trying to get on this train to Scotland. And a sailor came, picked me up in his arms, carried me on the train, and put me in the luggage rack and said, "You'll get there somehow." And I did.
Yeah.
So we could not, in that little brief time each month, Jean and I come back to Scotland. And that was where we experienced the hospitality of many of our colleagues in the Wrens, many of whom at that time, and I must stress only at that time in the early days, were society girls. Many of them were ex-debutantes. Many of them were ex-Oxford, Cambridge graduates. Many of them were titled. We had one royal, a lesser royal figure, I've forgotten her name. But they were super, super girls, but for two little girls from Scotland, it was a bit overwhelming. We had a lovely time, I remember, going to Goudhurst in Kent to a village, and our pal who took us there was obviously from a wealthy family, and we had the most wonderful bedroom and ensuite there, each of us, Jean and I, and were really spoiled and travelled around in a horse and trap with this Wren's mother, who was like a laird of the village, that's what we would have called her in Scotland. We had experiences like that. But also, Jean and I got old bicycles and cycled a lot. We also hitchhiked a lot with army lorries during those days. So we saw a lot of England. We got down to Devon once. We had adventures, Jean and I, in those days. But of course, we did get home to Scotland on our annual leaves.
So you said that you worked, so you had a monthly pattern of of work. And you said you worked a week on each watch.
Yes.
And then that next week you did a couple of days working and then you had a few days off.
Yes.
So you worked 3 weeks continuously, did you?
Yes.
No day off at
yes.
all? Really?
Yes. We had no days off, but you could have a little bit of time off sometimes when you were overlapping.
Of course, yes.
Because you had to change from one watch to the other. And that would, sometimes, I can remember, it gave you almost 24 hours.
Right.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
But officially, we had no time off until we had worked the 3 weeks that I described. And then we did 3 to 4 days of 8 hours on, eight hours off.
So you might on one day do 8 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon and then be off again until four o'clock the following day.
And that would give you 24 hours, wouldn't it?
Yes.
And that was something that we learned to treasure. And I was I think I was quite a good wren. I didn't try to dodge the system at all. But one time I got the opportunity to go and see Reinhold, my Polish boyfriend, in London. And I was able to go on duty at Bletchley from midnight to 8 in the morning, and then not to go on the coach back to Gayhurst to go to bed, but take a train into London and meet Reinhold and have a day with him at the zoo, come back and report on duty that night. But of course, I had given up a day's sleep, which was very wrong of me. I can remember doing that at least once, and I was glad I did that because it was after that he was killed.
Right.
So we were supervised, but not supervised to the extent that you couldn't manipulate the system occasionally because it was easy in Bletchley to get a train to London, and I knew that I could turn up on duty. And I think I only did it the once, but I did do that. That was very wrong.
Right. You might be able to help me because we've got a little bit of a mystery. So you say it's very easy from Bletchley to get a train. Do you remember how you got from Bletchley to the train station?
Walked.
You walked?
Definitely.
Do you remember anything of that walk from Bletchley Park itself to the train station?
No, I remember I had no difficulty at all because I remember we always got straight onto the coach. This is why we didn't really feel always part of Bletchley Park, because immediately we came off duty, we got on our coach to go back to Gayhurst.
Right.
And it was very easy for me just not to get on the coach. We were not checked out. You couldn't afford to do that because of lack of sleep.
Mm.
But we were young. You could manage it occasionally.
Those coaches, do you remember anything about the buses, how big they were, how many people they carried? Was it like we'd imagine a bus or a coach now, or was it something much smaller?
No, no, it was as we imagine a coach now.
So?
Yes. And so there'd be 40, maybe. I don't remember too much about numbers.
Right. No. Was everybody on board that coach, were they all bomb operators, or were they coming in to do other duties at Bletchley Park?
No. They were all going to Hut 11, Hut 11A. And Hut 11A really it was by that time, I think. And no, we moved very much just as a group, working together, living together.
Did you stay on the same watch then?
Yes.
So with the same group of wrens, and you all moved together to different watches?
We were all on the same watch. And so the cabins that we had were up in the top of this Gayhurst Manor, where I suppose the attics would be, the attic bedrooms, perhaps the servants' bedrooms at one time. And I was in watch B, I think, at that time. And so you all slept in the same big room.
Right.
And I remember I had the only leading wren sleeping above me, so I had to behave quite well. She was an older woman.
When you entered the park in the bus, did you have to show your security passes? Were people checked?
No,
did you drive?
I don't remember that.
Right.
I only remember that when this Italian escaped prisoner of war claimed sanctuary in the little church in the grounds, it was a Church of England in the grounds of Gayhurst Manor, security began to be stepped up a bit. But it was a very pleasant life because any spare time we had, we could, for instance, go and ride these horses or we could go into the little village, you know. It was a very pleasant way to live.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And it was a lovely, lovely house. And we didn't see very much of Sir Walter. I'd learned afterwards that quite a few of his staff at that time were people who came from institutions because it was so difficult to get staff at that time.
Right.
And so that was why they were a little bit odd. But we had good fun with them, especially when they used the sliding walls and the
Yeah, that was a wonderful part of the story. At Bletchley Park itself, you worked an 8-hour watch. Did you have time in that 8 hours for food or a short break?
I have very vague memories of this. I've been trying to think of this. I think, didn't we go to a mess somewhere in the mansion house sometime for food? I remember we paid no attention to any of the other huts, you know, hut 6, hut 8. We knew of, because we knew the story of what was happening to the work we were doing. But we operated our bombs. We just had a week's training on the job to learn how to use
them. And that was at Bletchley Park?
At Bletchley Park.
Right. So if we talk through the work, so you were in 11A. Did you ever go into Hut 11 itself? Do you remember what Hut 11 was for?
I don't remember that at all. It was for the Wrens, I know that. Right. Hut 11 and 11A were, I understand, for the Wrens. But as I remember, I was in Hut 11A. And we did not really, fraternise very much. We knew the people we worked with, and that was it.
So if you were going on watch, what would happen? You'd arrive at the door of 11A. What would you do when you arrived at the door?
Go into the bomb that we'd been allocated.
Right. Did you just walk straight in, or was there any security?
I don't remember security.
Right.
But I do remember that we really had very little contact with any other hut.
Right. So what do you remember of the interior? How many bomb machines were there?
8 to 10, I think.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Was it just the Wrens in there, or were there other people in there as well?
I only remember Wrens, and I don't really remember any of the machines breaking down. But I do know that we were told that there were people at hand. The bombs needed help.
There was nobody maintaining, repairing, servicing the machine?
No, you see, and that there was no RAF there. The RAF did not come on the scene to help us until the outstations were set up.
Right.
But that was where there was the need of the RAF. I know quite a lot about that because of my husband. Yeah. But the RAF were brought in to do the work of setting a bomb right that Alan Turing or his people would have undertaken had we been at Bletchley Park, as I understand it.
Okay. All of the Wrens that were in 11A were operating the bomb machines. So was there more than one Wren on each machine? Can you remember?
There were two, I think.
Right. And how did that work? How did the two of them work? Because what did you actually have to do to the machines themselves?
We had to set it up when we got the menu.
Right. So somebody brought you a menu.
Yes.
Do you remember where that came from?
I don't.
Right. So that was just given to you. So there's two of you on the machine.
Mm-hmm.
You're given the menu. And what did you then do once you were given the menu?
We set up the machine. And I don't remember exactly how we did it. But I remember we had to make sure that the brush, on the drums.
On the back of the drums, yeah.
Yes, that they did not short.
Right. So were those drums permanently on the machines?
No. We had to set it up, putting the appropriate drums in place according to our menu.
Right.
And we had to plug up at the rear of the machine. We had a menu given to us that took us quite some time, if you like, to set it up.
For each machine, was there just one set of drums or was there more?
One set, but that was a huge amount.
Right. So you set the drums up, you plugged up the back. What did you then do? You started the machine, I guess.
Yes. The bomb was a bronze-coloured cabinet, about 8 feet tall, 7 feet wide. The front housed rows of coloured circular drums, and inside each drum was a multitude of wires, every one of which had to be meticulously adjusted with tweezers to make sure that the electric circuits did not short. This was the Turing brush. The back of the machine was a mass of dangling plugs on rows of letters and numbers. The first computer, no, the Colossus, also set up at Bletchley, was the first computer. But how were the messages received and the bombs set up? I've tried to describe how the Enigma machine used 3 and later 4 rotors or wheels to provide a continuously changing an electrical path from an input key to an output lamp. The operator pressed down a key on the typewriter board, and a lamp would light up, illuminating a letter on the panel. This was the enciphered letter of the key just pressed, and that had to be written down for later transmission by Morse code on a radio link. And these enciphered messages could be intercepted using radio receivers. Interceptors were stationed in different parts of the UK. This was called the Y service. After intercepting, the next step was deciphering. But Enigma allowed an enormous number of different settings to be used for each message. The codebreaker had to find out which rotors were in the machine and in which order, and then the alphabet setting on each rotor had to be found. The start position of each rotor had to be worked out, and the plug board connections had to be found. The total number of combinations of all these elements for a three-rotor Enigma machine is 1.5 times 10 to the power of 20. So how could one possibly break such a code? It was the human characteristics of the German operators that led to a breakthrough, and this was where the interceptors played their part. And I've known many interceptors and met with them since being a civilian. Often the German operators left clues. They were instructed always to have a greeting before they sent out the actual message. And being orderly people, the Germans would use the same greeting of introduction. And this was a sort of clue that the operators left, using the same greeting or introduction for each message. Perhaps it would just be a simple good morning or a weather report. But we do know an instance, and I had this explained to me by someone, where an operator in Germany always referred to his girlfriend by name before he transmitted the message. When this was recognised, the repeated greeting could be used as a crib. A crib was a section of German text which was thought to be the actual text. So when a crib was identified for a particular message, a so-called menu was constructed with pencil and paper, and this menu was formed from places in the crib where enciphered letters and crib letters formed patterns of relationships. A letter could never be encoded so that you got the same letter. It was always another letter. So the crib could be slid along under the text until no letter appeared under itself. And this coded message came from the interceptor to the Bletchley Park controller, to the teleprinter operator, and then to the WRNS. And the menu was plugged up by the WREN operator. She had to select the set of rotors and then plug up at the rear of the bomb all the electrical connections corresponding to the menu relationships. And the bomb was set running at high speed, searching for rotor positions at which all the relationships were satisfied. And if one was found, the bomb stopped. And this result was tested to see if it actually deciphered the message. So this was when knowledge of the German language was necessary. And a complete run would take about 15 minutes. But that was on the rotors which had been selected. There were 60 sets of rotors, and so a whole run on all the rotors would take perhaps 30 hours. It was heavy work getting a bomb set up, and it had to be done at top speed and, of course, with 100% accuracy. The bombs were noisy when they were operating, because each row of drums revolved at a different speed. But it was wonderful when a stop came. It was more wonderful when news came back that the code was broken. And it was a tremendous thrill if it was your machine that had been successful. But that code which was broken was the code for that day only. The Germans changed the wheel settings daily, so our job never ended. And it was important that Hitler did not know that we were able to break the codes, so the information must always appear to have come from some other source.
That was brilliant.
Well, that's my experience. I don't know whether it's accurate. So, it's my experience.
So how much of that did you know at the time? You obviously knew what you were doing, but how much did you know about the Interceptors and, you know, Alan Turing? Did you ever hear his name mentioned?
Oh, yes, indeed. And it must have been when we were maybe going out to have something to eat somewhere, you would occasionally bump into him. And he would stand and talk to a wren just as happily as stand and talk to a bigwig.
Really?
Yeah. He was very, very friendly and treated us with courtesy. That didn't happen very often. And it didn't really excite us because everybody we thought was nice. We enjoyed bumping into all sorts of people when we went over to the mansion, which was not very often. Because people often ask me when I'm talking to them, did you ever meet Turing? No, I was never introduced to him. But if we were passing him, he would stop and chat with us. He was a bit of an eccentric, of course, wasn't he?
Yes.
It didn't really thrill us at the time, but when we began to hear about it later, I thought, he just passed the time of day with me quite happily.
So you would have seen him?
Oh, yes.
I'm fairly sure you've seen
him. Oh, yes, yes, oh, yes.
All right.
And it's quite difficult to remember because it really wasn't important that we'd seen him at the time. Do you know what I mean? We were all there together.
Yes.
And we didn't think our job was unimportant.
Right.
But we knew it was pretty low down the scale, I think.
So your job then, having set up the bomb machines, you said in there that they'd run for about 15 minutes and that the drums were looking for the relationships between the pairs of letters.
Mm-hmm.
If I've understood you correctly, once every single set of three drums had identified that relationship at the same time, it would stop. Is that right?
Yes.
What would you then do when it stopped?
Check it.
Check
it. We were taught how to check it. We had a wee checking machine.
What was there on the machine that actually you went and checked? Can you remember?
No, I can't.
What I'm trying to get at,
I know,
is not really meant to do this, but as you can't remember, perhaps if I can help fill in what I think is the gap, there were three gold-coloured drums down on the right-hand side of the machine. And then on the side of the machine, there was a little, like, gauge. Do you remember taking the settings off those?
Yes, I do.
Does that sound right to you?
Yes, I do. I remember taking the settings off.
And then that's what you took onto the checker machine?
Yes.
Does that sound right?
That sounds right.
I don't want to sound like I'm feeding you something, but I think we've got a gap there.
Yes, it is a gap. Because, as I recall, we were taught right from the beginning how to check a stop. But, of course, it was passed over to the people in, I can't remember whether it was Hut 6 or Hut 8, but whichever, and they decoded it. But I think all we did was make sure when the machine stopped, and this is why we needed a knowledge of German, that our machine had stopped and spouted forth German. And was it gobbledygook or was it the German language that it was giving us? And we had sufficient knowledge, of course, of German to recognise that it was indeed a German message that our machine was giving us. And that was immediately given to the people who were then going to decode it.
So the two of you that were on the machine, did you both stand waiting for the 15 minutes and the stop?
Yes.
You both stood and there with the same machine?
Yes, and there were times, I'm sure, when there was only one of us.
Right.
But I think there were two allocated. It's hard to remember completely because I remember I spoke about my machine and so did everybody. So it was almost as if we helped each other out at times rather than have two allocated.
Yes.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Because we were very proud of my machine, my bomb, you know.
Yeah.
But I remember how different it was at the outstation.
Right.
Because the thing became much more organised. Because we were in Hut 11A, we had our machine, our bomb, we did our own checking of the messages and so forth, purely to make sure that it was the German language that we were then passing on to the hut.
So the two of you would take those readings off the three drums and off the gauge on the side, and you would then put that through the checker machine.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. But when we went to Eastcote, for instance, that whole thing changed and the message that had been received was not checked by the operator. It went to the checker's room,
right,
where it was checked by special checkers.
Okay.
I think that's right anyway.
So if you checked it, and it wasn't gobbledygook, it was what you were looking for, what would you then do?
Oh, it would be handed over to the hut that dealt with that. We'd done our job.
So who did you give it to?
It would be passed, I can't remember whether it was Hut 6 or Hut 8.
Right.
It was one or other of them.
Would you go to Hut 6 or Hut 8?
No, was it a phone call? No, no. There was some system that it was slid through some kind of device.
So you'd pass it on and somebody else would...
Yeah. We had no contact at all, physical contact, as individuals, with individuals in other huts.
Right. So what if it came out as gobbledygook? It hadn't worked. What would you then do?
Restart the machine.
Right.
And it would go on until it stopped again.
Would you do anything to the machine?
No.
Second time round?
No, not to my memory. But right. You must remember that because I've not talked of the intricacies of all that over the years, it's not clear that everything is just as it was.
Right.
But I am very clear that we had no contact at all as Wrens with people from other huts.
Right.
It was all done automatically.
But you did get the messages back if they'd broken the code. You got that feedback.
Yes,
that came
did.
Back to you in Hut 11A.
Mm. It was a great celebration.
Yeah.
If we'd broken the code.
Right.
And in the first days of my being there, it happened very seldom that we got good news. Whereas by the time we were going to outstations, the success rate was much higher. That amazes me when I think back on it. But if our machine stopped, we could ourselves check that stop. But that led to all sorts of, consequences, because I remember one time a machine stopping and we had sufficient German, the girl beside me and I, to know that it was not only could we decipher it as German, we could make out what the message was saying, and it was that a ship had gone down. It was a British ship and all had been lost. And her husband was captain of that ship. And that's how she learned that she'd lost her husband. I remember that. And I remember the shock that we unofficially knew this. At the end of that watch, she was summoned to whoever was in charge that night and told that indeed her husband had gone down with his ship.
Terrible.
And she was a Cockney girl. She'd been fortnight married and she had come and told us of her wedding and her wedding night and her wonderful wedding nightgown in great detail. And I can remember her coming back from that interview and she just said to me, "This bloody war, let's get it finished with." And she didn't take a day off work or anything like that. And that's why it has puzzled me when I have been reading recently of quite a lot of women who had breakdowns at Bletchley Park. And then I have discovered through further reading that they were nearly all civilian women in much more high-ranking jobs than ours. But they did not have the support, as we did, of service people around them. When we had bad news, we had so many girls around us to support us. Mm. And I don't remember anybody in my experience of the Wrens taking time off or suffering any kind of breakdown that was obvious because of the loss of a loved one.
Mm.
And that is not, I understand, the common experience of many of the, you'll know perhaps more about that than I do, a lot of the women who had really high-ranking jobs, but they went back to an empty bedroom at night, perhaps not terribly congenial, landlady or so forth, and she would have to suffer all that herself.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I'm making too much of that.
No, I don't think you are. So I think you said you thought you'd join the Wrens about April, May, 42.
I had my interview.
Oh, your interview.
And it was September 42 that I got my call-up papers to go to Mill Hill.
Oh, okay, so that's when you went. And how long were you at Mill Hill for?
It was just over, it was between 1 and 2 weeks.
Right.
Very short time.
Right, so September. So when do you think you would have arrived at Bletchley Park?
September 42.
September 42. You were at Gayhurst for about a year.
From September 42. 1942 to September 43.
Right.
And then I was sent to Eastcote as a leading wren promotion.
So you were at Bletchley Park and Gayhurst for about a year.
Yes.
What happened then? You obviously got transferred to Eastcote, but were you just told you were going, or did you volunteer? Did you?
Oh, no, no. You were told that that's where you were going, and to my surprise, I got this little tiny bit of promotion to right. leading wren. Very few of us got that.
Right.
And I was going to Eastcote as a leading wren. And when I got to Eastcote, I think there were about 200 wrens there. I'm told there were more than that eventually. And that, of course, is where we were introduced to the RAF.
Right.
Because we no longer were at Bletchley Park, where we could be helped if our machines went wrong. So the RAF, I think there were 50 RAF at Eastcote. And that's my husband's story.
Right.
Because that's where I met him.
And you were at Eastcote to the end of the war,
yeah,
a few months afterwards.
Yeah, because I was only a leading wren for 4 months, and in January 1944... I was made a petty officer.
Right.
Now, there were very few petty officers, so I was very, maybe fortunate, but I was then sent to a different watch, I think it was C Watch, and I worked with Petty Officer Joan Allam. I remember that very clearly. And she was an experienced menu drawer-upper and taught me, because she had done that for some time.
Right.
And I shared her office. And we drew up the menus. We were next door to the teleprinter room.
Right.
And we got to know the teleprinter operator very well indeed. And she put through the window the messages as they came. Joan was a very astute, clever woman. She was not a socialiser. I was a socialiser, I think. But she was a good person. And it was Petty Officer Joan Allam, and there was Petty Officer Pamela Gibbons that I remember, because there were very few of us. And, of course, we worked in what I called the corridor of power. We were not in the bays anymore. Although, if somebody had to go to a bay, Joan would send me, because she was superior in rank to me. That was a very different life, and I did that from January 1944 till the end of the war. Really.
So as a leading wren, then, you were in charge of a bay?
Yes, and you were very much doing checking,
right.
checking the stops.
Right. Oh, yes, because you'd mentioned it was a different arrangement.
Yes, there was a checker's room. And maybe because, you see, speed was of the essence. The codes were being broken quickly,
yeah.
very much more successful. And so when a stop came, as I can remember it, it was just sent to the checker's room and we would just continue.
And then what would happen to the bomb?
Well, you obviously had to hear back from the checker's room whether right. it had been successful or not.
And if it was successful, what would they do?
Strip it.
Right.
And then set it up again. They were always in constant
Throw
use.
On the menu. Right. Mm-hmm. I've gathered so far that the teleprinter operator would receive something that they passed on to you. What do you remember that came through to you? What did it look like?
I don't remember this clearly. It was just lots and lots of letters. It was the Morse code, really.
Right. So in all this time, Bletchley Park as well, could you ever relate anything that had happened, anything that you'd done, to perhaps something that you'd seen in the newspaper or in the news, any particular events or anything like that, anything that maybe you'd helped with?
Well, I told you about the girl who discovered that her husband's ship had gone down.
Yeah.
I keep reading accounts and how we'd no idea of what we were doing, and that was how the secret was kept.
Right.
And I don't think that that is strictly accurate. We did know how important our work was,
yeah.
and we could relate it sometimes. But I don't think that made much difference to us.
Right.
I attended a lecture on the Enigma machine in a little theatre in the Lake District round about 10, 15 years ago. And the man who was giving the lecture was purely talking about the Enigma machine as a machine. And he dedicated his talk, there were about 400 people in that theatre, he dedicated his talk to an unnamed group of women who were the wrens at Bletchley Park who had done all this work. And I remember he said, "Are any of them present?" And there was a girl in the first row who was in a wheelchair, and there was me away up beyond. And he got us each to talk. And I followed on the first woman who gave the little talk about her experience as a wren. at Bletchley Park, and I followed on, and she was very, very loquacious and covered it all. So I just said, very nice to be remembered tonight, but why not remember the RAF who came and helped us? A group of serving men who have never really had any kind of recognition. And he said, that's a point well made. But my sister, who was sitting beside me, shouted out, and she married one of them, you know.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.